It's Joe Lowry. On this episode of the Global Lithium Podcast, I have a conversation with James Elsmore, a millennial who's known as a digital nomad, and we'll talk a little bit more about that concept later in the podcast. He is the founder of Island Innovation, a frequent contributor to Forbes magazine, and a keynote speaker around the world on the subject of sustainability. This year, I will be broadening the guest portfolio on the podcast, and James is a good example of that. James works to develop renewable energy projects requiring energy storage in rural and remote locations. Energy storage systems are a small but rapidly growing part of lithium demand. In addition to speaking with James, I will talk a little bit about my trip to Argentina a few days ago, and some other timely topics. And now, James Elsmore. Welcome to another edition of the Global Lithium Podcast. Today, we take a small diversion from the norm. I'm here in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and James Elsmore also happened to be in Buenos Aires, Argentina. So this is another by iPhone opportunistic podcast. James is kind of in an adjacent space to what the normal lithium podcast guest is. He's passionate about energy storage and projects related to that space in rural and island areas, which I think is a very interesting aspect. So I'm going to just start with James by asking him a little bit about his backstory. James, where did you come from?
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me on today. Well, I'll just briefly mention, so the organization, the company that I founded is Island Innovation, and we work on sustainable development projects, which I kind of leave deliberately broad, in rural, remote, and island communities. The idea is that these disparate communities have certain challenges that makes sustainable development very different to the traditional city areas that you see as your centers for innovation. But I come from a very rural background. My parents are farmers, grew up in rural England, and moved to the US for college, studied in North Carolina, and after that did my master's in island studies at the University of the Highlands and Islands, looking at the development challenges that they have there. And energy is a key issue for islands across the world. Generally high cost energy or electricity compared to the mainland. If you look at the Scottish Islands, the highest levels of energy poverty in the UK. If you look at the Caribbean, the cost of electricity is generally 3 to 6 times higher than Americans are paying. So energy is at the core of this question of how you do development in these remote island regions.
Tell me a little bit about how you came to be in Buenos Aires in your life as in James. You are the first digital nomad that I have had on the podcast. So if you could tell me a little bit about how you just happened to be in Argentina this time, and kind of, I think you were on a digital nomad cruise, if I'm not mistaken.
So I have been living basically remotely for the last 3 years. Normally try and stay in a place anywhere from 2 to 4 months, mostly in Latin America and the Caribbean, but go back to Europe and the US as well. And essentially, the modern way of working, I guess, everything that I do is online and can really be done anywhere. And occasionally when I have a project in a specific place, I can fly there, visit there, and spend a longer time there. I'm in Buenos Aires because I was originally on my way to Chile for the COP climate conference. So the United Nations climate conference was meant to be in Santiago the first 2 weeks of December. Understandable reasons, ended up getting cancelled due to the problems in Chile at the time. I'd already booked myself on a cruise going from Spain to South America with the plan of them flying on. Then, of course, they moved the conference to Spain, which was just my luck. But the cruise was designed for digital nomads, nomad crews, a repositioning cruise. And really, it was an online a conference on the boat for 2 weeks where people from a wide variety of backgrounds, all of whom lived on this digital nomad lifestyle, were coming together and talking about their businesses. And really, for me, it was just a really interesting opportunity to meet a whole range of people and learn about how they were doing location-independent businesses and lifestyles.
So, being a millennial, which I am by looking at you, assuming you are in that in that group, the digital nomad lifestyle, how did you, I mean, as I understand it, you've never actually had what we would classically call
a real job.
So how did you come to that, and then how does that play into what you're actually doing with your life right now?
Right, so I think originally it was going to college in the US from the UK and being back and forth between the US and the UK. I got used to moving around a lot. And the opportunity after graduation, I had several opportunities to work freelance on some different projects. For a while I was starting to get my business up and running, I was actually doing online college counseling as the bulk of my income while I was trying to build up a portfolio of projects, etc. And now I've got to the point where I have plenty of projects and work online. And so the idea was, I guess, I've also heard the term digital native, you know, just grew up with the internet being everything. And it was a natural progression to me that why limit myself to working with clients from a specific location? And I think my interest in development in these remote spaces also led me to have the opportunity to see places like the Scottish Islands and the Caribbean, which I've mentioned already, and actually see a surprising amount of commonality between them. Obviously, the weather's different, the culture's different, the language is different, but these issues, high energy price, brain drain, difficulties in disposing waste, coastal plastic pollution, they're very common between the two regions, but yet there's not that many opportunities to interact with them. So the fact that I was able to travel and share stories of a successful project in Jamaica with people living on a remote Scottish island was fantastic. And I built up this platform on Island Innovation. So we now have 12,000 people on the subscribers for my weekly newsletter. But then also a Facebook group where we have 2,000 people from all over the world sharing stories. And I think something, going on a slight tangent here, but something that really illustrated what I was trying to do a couple of weeks ago, I saw a post from someone in Vanuatu who had shared a project in Vanuatu that they'd done. I'm trying to remember, I think it was an energy project in a remote island community within the archipelago. Someone from Jamaica then replied to that and said, oh, we need to do more of this in Jamaica, send me some more info. And then someone from Orkney in Scotland then commented, oh, we did a similar project here. And so for me, seeing something as simple as a Facebook group with these three people from almost as far apart as you can imagine, then sharing stories and sharing information and learning from each other, that encompasses the idea of what I've been trying to do.
How do you think the learning culture that you're kind of talking about now winds up playing out when you're putting these groups together? I mean, now you have the capability with the internet and with social media to connect quickly, but then what commonality do you see in how the different disparate people communicate, and are they bringing up the same issues, or, you know, what are the common threads?
Yeah, I think the issues are surprisingly similar in these very different. It doesn't matter if the country is a poorer country or a richer country. There's obviously going to be differences that come from that. But the core principles for these islands is often the same. People tend to be closer to nature, which is a bit of that might sound a bit like a stereotype, but often the jobs, if you're working in fishing or farming, because of that, you're closer to the natural environment, and so you're more aware of some of those things. And I think one of the issues now with information is we have access to as much information as we want. It's sorting through it. So getting information is not the problem. It's or having the information available is not the problem. It's organizing it and finding it and sorting it and trying to make that. So that's what I've been working on with that community. Last year, we ran an online event called the Virtual Island Summit. We had 4,000 islanders and adjacent coastal communities, for example, join us from all over the world to share and discuss different ideas. And part of the reason for doing that as a virtual event was that if we'd have done a physical event in, say, the Caribbean, it would have been very, very biased towards one community. And we wanted to make it accessible for as many as possible. So we had 4,000 people join, sharing different stories. And it also meant, so we had a panel on electric vehicles, for example. And it meant that we could have a speaker, I can't remember exactly where they were from, but it could have been something like Iceland, Barbados, Fiji, and Mauritius. And those four islands could each talk about their experiences. And as well as having four different representatives from different places, it also, we could bring in the universities, the private sector, the government, and the different stakeholders, trying to get them to then talk to each other. So it's not only building kind of virtual bridges between islands, but then also bridging these different sectors, all of which need to collaborate but often don't really know how to talk to each other.
Let's talk a little bit about something that seems dear to your heart from me reading your blog, and that would be the current most popular buzzword across corporate circles, and that's sustainability. So what, when you talk about sustainability, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, everyone wants to be sustainable these days. As you say, any corporate organization is now having a chief sustainability officer. That's a newest role, and unfortunately there's a lot of BS out there because of that. There's a lot of greenwashing that comes from it, where people simply rebrand what they're doing as sustainable without actually changing it. I think in the context of development and these remote areas, sustainability comes in multiple forms. There's obviously the environmental sustainability element, reducing plastic waste, trying to reduce emissions, for example, moving to greener energy sources and reducing the risk of pollution. Especially if you're in a tourism-dependent community, your income is directly tied to how pristine your natural environment is. There's obviously economic sustainability that comes from wanting to have reliable, sustainable, long-term incomes and avoid the troughs and peaks, again, often related to tourism is a good example. And then the social sustainability, trying to work out how development and change can benefit across the community as opposed to money being sucked in or sucked out of the community. So I think I often think of it as more broadly than just the environment. When we talk about islands, though, one thing that does come up a lot is climate change. The Caribbean and small island developing states in the Pacific and other areas, you tend to think of them as the most vulnerable countries to climate change, whether that's sea level rise, increase of hurricanes, drought, all of these things, they're kind of on the front line. And so the governments in these countries are all looking at how they can obviously adapt to climate change, assuming that that's inevitably going to happen. They've got to get used to that and lobby other countries in how they can move forward. So I think the interesting element then becomes, well, okay, yes, these island communities might be on the front line of climate change, but that is also an opportunity in the sense of they are working out how they can move quicker and innovate and adapt. And so you see a lot of interesting projects coming from islands. As I mentioned with the high energy cost as well, if you're in a community that's paying 5 times more for your electricity than the adjacent mainland area, that is a pretty good incentive to innovate and adapt and change how you do things. And so some of the most innovative energy projects have come out from small island communities that have looked for new solutions. So actually, the first community to move to 100% renewable energy, I think it was 2011, was a very remote island in the Pacific called Tokelau, where they installed one of the biggest energy storage. I can't remember off the top of my head how big it was, but it was a small community, 2,000 people, but they installed enough solar to be able to, solar plus storage, to be able to make that community rely on that, because they were paying, I think it was almost $1 a kilowatt hour for their electricity, so 10 times more than the average American probably, and it was so extreme that they wanted to find a way of moving away from that. And it just happened that as well as being more sustainable, it was also more financially viable for them. And of course, if you're using an indigenous source of energy like solar, that also tends to keep the money in the community, as opposed to just sending money off island every few months to import fossil fuels.
So as you work on projects in different parts of the world, what do you see your role as? Are you a catalyst to get energy storage done? Or are you more or less trying to get communication between sources of funding and the various stakeholders? What's your space in this space?
Yeah, me personally, I think, I mean, I'm not an engineer. I don't have a technical background. But it kind of comes back into what you were saying about being the digital nomad before, because I've had the opportunity to see these very disparate locations and spend time in them. I've been able to see those commonalities, which might not have been as obvious to other people. And so I would see myself as really a connector, trying to bridge and make these connections between the island communities to share stories. I'm a writer, so I'm writing and featuring stories on my blog and the newsletter. I used to write for Forbes, so I would write about them there. But then also across the different stakeholders. So I see, and energy is a really good example of an industry where you have to have the private sector, the utility, the government, potentially, although to a lesser extent, universities and nonprofits and charities, all on the same page. Because often all these different sectors, they want the same thing, but they work in complete isolation and they don't necessarily know how to talk to each other. So I've been able to work with those different groups and help bring them together and help bridge those conversations between sectors as well. And although energy was where I started out from, I think when you're looking at a small island community, you can't talk about energy and then ignore the waste problem. And you can't necessarily ignore the waste problem when you're talking about ocean health. So all of these different sectors kind of come together and have commonalities.
When you look at the benefits of the community you talked about before, where they were able to use storage and then basically cut their energy costs down, and earlier you referenced brain drain.
Yeah.
Do you see, as people get greater access to lower cost energy and life improves in these places, do you see that as helping some of the brains stay home?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question. There's a fantastic organization in Scotland called Island Revival. Traditionally, the island, if you wanted to go up in your career and you wanted to
you wanted to move forward in life.
Yeah, if you wanted to go up in your career,
okay,
you would have to leave the islands, go to Edinburgh, go to Scotland, go to London, and do that. And now, it's almost the reverse of the digital nomad, that you can live anywhere. You can go and live in a small community of 600 people.
Sure.
If you've got a half-decent internet connection, you can run a multi-million-dollar company from there. Maybe fly to the capital once every month or however often you need. And so there's actually an opportunity now with greater connectivity that people can live in places and work from them and don't have to leave their communities. Whether that's to study, traditionally people would have to leave to study. And my university that I studied in, the Highlands and Islands, so the University of the Highlands and Islands was set up to provide education to the northern half of Scotland. I took a slightly different approach in that I did the degree with them, but I was living in the Caribbean at the time. But most of the other students in my classes that we would attend online were living in different parts of the remote islands and the Highlands region. And so I think that applies with businesses as well. So that kind of goes along with the digital nomad idea. I've seen several island communities, a great one, Arranmore off the Republic of Ireland. They're looking now at how they can retain population and attract people in, and they've just built this co-working space that is designed to bring people to spend the summer there and work from there.
So another question about the whole, you referenced, I think, 4,000 people attending this one remote conference you did, and you had to have an internet connection to do that. So is what you're doing also helping bolster the connectivity because there's more uptime on internet, there's more chances for people to connect? I mean, do you see any relationship between improving the electrical uptime on these islands, improving the connectivity between them? I mean, it's...
Yeah, so I think 5 years ago, it would have been difficult to do the Virtual Island Summit. The idea was that most remote communities would have very, very slow internet and just wouldn't have been able to join. That's really changing now. You do have some communities that still struggle with internet connection, but actually the fastest internet in Europe is in the Faroe Islands, which is 50,000 people in the middle of the North Atlantic. So I think that's a great example of how some of these remote communities are actually now having extremely fast internet speeds, and that is changing rapidly. So I think that's going to become less and less of a problem. There are still very poor remote areas that obviously struggle with internet connection, struggle with electricity. But for those islands that, or areas that maybe used to have 6 hours, 7 hours a day of electricity and are now being able to have 24, the impact of electricity is not just on... the impact of electricity affects lots of different things. So you can now study in the evenings. And that's what I think is really exciting about renewables. Often, the wider society, you think about renewable energy, and most people go straight to climate change and carbon emissions. And maybe that's part of it. Well, obviously that's part of it. But what about the kid in rural Kenya who now has light for 3 hours in the evening, or the clinic in that village that can now store medicine because they have a fridge that operates 24 hours a day? And the one that I mentioned in the Pacific, Tokelau, when they got renewable energy and they got 24-hour power for the first time, of course that affected so many parts of their life, and one of that was how connected they were with internet as well.
When you look at these island projects, and this just shows my ignorance of what's going on in islands around the world, what percentage, is this almost all solar, or is there some wind involved too? I mean, are we doing both types of the main types of renewables? If you look at, it's a lot easier to deploy solar than to put up a proper wind power, but there are smaller units. I'm just curious because I really have no idea.
There's a range, and also hydro and geothermal come into play in certain places, but obviously there's even more geographical restrictions on those. I'd say solar's the most deployed, I think, because it is, it's less... There are fewer political and technological challenges of doing solar, and also it can be distributed in a way. But now, I mean, you're seeing in Jamaica is a good example. There's several big solar farms there now, but there's also a wind farm. But I think as a percentage, solar is higher. Wind is getting there, and I've also coming more from the solar industry. So wind, I'm trying to think in the Caribbean. I know that Jamaica has one, and Aruba and Curaçao both have them. But otherwise, I don't know of any other big wind farms off the top of my head. But every island has got solar of some level. Obviously, if you're looking at Scotland and Norway, if you're in the North Atlantic, wind is a bigger part of it there. But solar also in the Caribbean tends to be more consistent sun than there is wind.
James, tell me a little bit about the climate change conference that you referenced going to, and what were the main takeaways from that?
So for the last couple of years, I've been on the support team for the Republic of Seychelles, which is a Indian Ocean island country. And as I mentioned before, a lot of these islands are very aware of the risk that face them because of climate change. And so they're keen that these processes at the international level, at the United Nations, have some kind of outcomes. But there's also a big part of that is the funding, the fact that the Green Climate Fund, for example, was agreed at these climate conferences and is essentially a money transfer from the big polluters, Europe, United, well, not the United States because they pulled out, but Europe and other large polluting countries to poorer, more vulnerable countries. And so a lot of that goes into funding renewable energy projects, adaptation projects, which could take a wide variety of forms. So in 2019, it was supposed to be in Chile. It got moved to Madrid at the last minute. In 2020, it's going to be in Glasgow. And that'll be an interesting opportunity for us in the United Kingdom, because we'll essentially have close to 200 world leaders coming to the UK to attend this conference at a time when the country needs friends and is trying to change its image on the world stage. And also our government is really positioning itself, despite being a conservative government, which in, for example, the US and Australia is not tended to be seen as a more environmentally or engaged one with climate change. In the UK, the government is really branding itself as a climate leader and environmentally friendly government. So we've got some interesting opportunities there. I'm excited. We have been working with some of the islands in Scotland for the past couple of years. Orkney Islands in the north of Scotland have the European Marine Energy Centre and some really advanced research on using wave and tidal energy. Obviously, having people from all over the world come to Scotland is an opportunity to showcase the research that they've done and look for applicability. But also all of these governments will be coming together, trying to have a more of a discussion. I'm probably a bit sceptical that much is going to come out of it. The last couple of years have unfortunately not been heading in particularly the right direction. But I do believe that there's a good opportunity here to, and we need to find some way for governments to agree on emissions and how globally we're going to tackle climate change.
Okay, I am going to do what we've done on most of the Global Lithium podcast at the end, and that's ask you a rapid fire question.
Okay.
And the rapid fire question would be, if you could have dinner with any historical figure, doesn't matter what era, we'll bring them back to life for you. Who's it going to be and what are you going to serve?
Who's it going to be? Oh, that is an interesting one because, I guess in the renewable energy industry, we're quite a young industry. So does it got to be a historical figure?
No, it could be anybody. It could be anybody going back 2,000 years. Any historical figure. This has nothing to do, in the spirit of this question, you don't have to bring it back to what you do for a living or anything else. It's just, as a person, who would you want to have dinner? You can even have two people. I'll let you pick two historical figures.
I'm struggling with one. Don't give me another one. Okay. I mean, the ones going through my head are kind of the more obvious ones. But I do think that in terms of the issues that we're now seeing today of around societies in Europe and in the US. Like someone like Nelson Mandela, who was able to bring together a country that was so divided at such a crucial time and kind of have unity within that country. That to me is like an incredible achievement on the high level. Another person who I think is a fascinating individual, still researching at I think the age of 97 is John Goodenough.
Sure.
I think I'd love maybe listen to your podcast. I don't know.
No, we actually had invited him and he had just taken a fall when we issued the invitation. This is some time back and he just respectfully declined, but I would love to have him on. And actually, I'm going to Austin to speak at an event next month, and I was going to see if he was.
I hope so. I just think as well. I mean, obviously, for all his life achievements, for what he's done, but the fact that he is still able to contribute so much, for nearly 100 years is just incredible on so many levels.
So we didn't. I mean, nobody's going to judge you for those two choices. I think you did well, and we don't judge here anyway. So. James, I want to thank you for connecting. We'd never met before, so it was kind of interesting that we both happened to be at Buenos Aires in the same time. And so where does your digital nomad life take you from here?
Well, I was going to say, this is the power of Twitter, isn't it? You saw I tweeted from Argentina. And you know what? I've met so many people through Twitter and different things like this. Next up, next week, up to Colombia. I spend around 5 or 6 months of the year, last 3 years, in Medellin, in Colombia, probably my favorite city. I love Buenos Aires, but Medellin on so many levels is my favorite city. So I'm going to be heading up there for a while, and then I'll go back to the UK to spend the summer. But I'm just going to wait till the weather gets a bit better before I go back home.
Okay, James, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, and I'll say good night and good luck. Before we go to the next section, I am going to add this section in, and hopefully it passes to all the forums where the podcast is heard. I make a mistake here in referring to Diego Maradona's Hand of God goal and say it's in the final of the 1986 World Cup versus West Germany. It was actually in the quarterfinal game
versus England. I actually was in West Germany those couple of weeks and remember clearly the final being on when I was having a dinner with a friend in West Germany. But I didn't pay any attention to football at the time, so I just remember it being a big deal that this World Cup thing was on. And as I mentioned, I watched a documentary on Diego Maradona on the flight home this week from Buenos Aires. But I do kind of mess this up. Yes, the hand of God goal was versus England, but no, it wasn't the final. Mea culpa. I just don't want any of my Argentine friends to have to write me correction notes, or any friends in England or Germany for that matter. This is just one time when I will say clearly that don't ever trust an American to talk about football.
I want to thank James Elsmore again for taking the time in Buenos Aires to sit down and explain what he's up to. I love the concept of the digital nomad, and that wasn't available to me when I was first out of college, given that the internet didn't exist. But I see the same kind of mindset in my children, and both of them really are in roles where they could be anywhere much of the time. So with that, if you're one of James Elsmore's 60,000 Twitter followers that are listening to this podcast, we're going to now turn to the topic of lithium. So if you want to sign off, I won't be offended. I spent some time in Argentina this week. It was really only one full day and parts of two others, but long enough to get the distinct feeling that Argentina will once again find a way to weather their current economic storm. Sometimes it seems like Argentines do better when circumstances are tough and expectations are low. And as an example of that, I will go back to a soccer metaphor, or if I was speaking to Argentines, a football metaphor. In 1986, when Argentina had a team with very low expectations, but Diego Maradona, and they won the World Cup versus England on the back of Maradona's kind of unseen hand goal. And I am stretching my football knowledge here, but I do recall that well, because I was in Germany having dinner with a friend that fateful day, and actually didn't even know what the World Cup was at the time. And it was, I watched a documentary on Maradona on the flight back from Buenos Aires, and it was very interesting to recall that day, because I do remember being in a bar with a lot of TVs on the 1986 World Cup and having absolutely no interest. That wouldn't happen again in current times, because I have developed an interest in football. But the point here being that I'm seeing lithium in Argentina is going to do well, even though there will be fits and starts along the way. Another story from South America this week is centered around Bolivia. And for those of you who are relatively new to the space, Bolivia has been trying to get into the lithium business for, they're now in their fifth decade. And that is not me getting the math wrong. You can go back to the 80s when FMC was trying to develop their first brine resource, and their first prospect was Bolivia. Now, this week we had an announcement that they would have a new quote unquote lithium czar. And as far as I'm concerned, this is just a continuation of the narrative of false hope. Dr. J.C. Zuleta is now named head of the state-owned lithium company, and he makes some claims, assuming he was properly quoted, that he can boost local production by bringing in outside technical expertise and be producing 50,000 tons within 5 years. I promise you that that is not going to happen. Maybe they'll have some progress. Maybe they'll actually get into production of exportable lithium chemicals, but 50,000 tons isn't going to happen. And, you know, this is just, reporters love to write this Bolivia narrative. And, you know, I have nothing against the country, but I do think I'm viewing history in context. And, you know, the idea that they're this time they're going to go it alone and don't need to depend on foreign investment, only foreign experts. A lot of people have been trying to develop lithium projects over the past few years, and talent is one of the biggest issues in getting teams capable of executing. So I'm doubting that the idea that they can just dial up some experts, teach the locals, and prosper is going to happen. And I think in Bolivia, for the most part, past will continue to be prologue. Moving to the Atacama, you know, the drama in the Atacama just keeps on giving. This week we saw SQM actually getting a favorable situation with a reversal of a negative court judgment. There's plenty on Twitter about this. I'm not going to belabor it, but, you know, it was good news. As I have said in the past, I have been in and out of SQM as an investment many times over the years. I've done very well. I was telling people that at 23, I was a buyer of SQM. And now, I mean, they topped 30 last week. I don't know if it will stay high or not. And this, you know, in the near term, but I think, you know, we're going to see the drama in the Atacama is not over, but, you know, there's, you know, people writing off SQM are making a mistake. I don't believe they'll be able to get to some of the big numbers of lithium capacity in the Atacama that they have talked about, but they certainly will grow. And, you know, I think it's you write them off at your peril. With that in mind, over the last few weeks, some of the lithium juniors, Orocobre, LAC, Galaxy, Neolithium, the stocks have risen substantially. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from people on Twitter, you know, via direct message on Twitter, various forums saying, well, it seems like you got it wrong, that the sentiment, the big upturn is already here and we're back to the glory days. I realize that's a happy thought, and I realize people really are dying to have the good old days of, you know, 2016 back. I look at what's happened to these stocks in the past month or a little less than a month as really a false positive, driven in part by Tesla's recent run-up and the surrounding optimism. I expect that most of these stocks that have jumped, you know, in the recent term are going to retreat again before they ultimately have a fundamentals driven run up, which I absolutely believe is going to come. As I said, I just am not sure if that happens in 2020 or if it's more of a 2021 story and based on simple concepts like executing their projects and ultimately earnings. So those are just a few of the things that I thought I would run by you. And then just one more comment. If you had an interest in kind of the concept that James Elmore was talking about, where he goes to remote areas, tries to help get projects done where renewables, you know, primarily at this point, solar are used to store energy and, you know, enable people to have electricity for more hours of the day. There is another related concept that I found fascinating. I listened to a Joe Rogan podcast the other day with a Welsh adventurer named Ash Dykes, and he walked the full length of the Yangtze River, which is the longest river that resides in one country on the planet. It's basically walking the length of China on the circuitous route of the Yangtze River. And one of the things he did to enable that was to carry a small solar panel that he could just put on his pack as he was hiking. And on sunny days, he could recharge the equipment he needed to use to stay alive and to document his journey. So if you're a long form podcast listener, and many of you wouldn't be listening to this if you weren't, I would suggest that you listen to that recent episode of the Joe Rogan podcast. And with that, I am going to leave it here. Just would like to say that gotten a lot of good feedback on my iPhone podcast, even though the sound quality is not as good as the more produced versions, it still seems to be adequate for most listeners. So I thank people that have supported me. To those who have written me longing for the good old days, I would just say that, things change. So with that, I will say good night and good luck.